October 1932. No satellites. No sirens. No warning. Just a sky that turned black, and a sea that rose like judgment. In Cuba's southern town of Santa Cruz del Sur, the ocean didn't crash, it swallowed. Entire families were erased. Churches washed away. A city vanished in the span of hours. No names. No graves. Just stories passed down in whispers. This isn't just a hurricane. It's the disaster history tried to forget. Drowned Without Warning is the true account of the 1932 Cuba hurricane, the deadliest storm in the nation's history. Told through lost testimonies, buried records, and generations of defiance, this is the story of survival, silence, and memory fighting to rise again. Because what we remember can save us, and what we forget can kill again. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. In the final days of October 1932, the people of Santa Cruz del Sur, a quiet coastal town in southern Cuba, were preparing for All Saints' Day. The fishermen hauled in their final nets. Vendors sold fresh bread in palm-woven baskets. Children chased after goats along coral-worn streets. And in the humid air above, a silence began to settle. Too quiet, too still. What they didn't know was that 300 miles away, over the Western Caribbean Sea, the deadliest hurricane in Cuba's recorded history was gaining strength. Rapidly. In the early 20th century, the science of meteorology was still in its infancy in the Caribbean. Weather forecasts relied on ships and barometers, not satellites. Even with limited U.S. Navy radio reports being relayed to Havana, communication across the Cuban provinces was slow, fragmented, and often ignored by the working class. It was this gap between knowledge and access that would define the death toll. A country already under strain, the hurricane's arrival came at a time of deep political instability. In 1932, Cuba was under the authoritarian rule of President Gerardo Machado. His regime, once praised for modernization, had descended into repression, censorship, and widespread poverty. Political opposition was crushed. Trade unions were disbanded. And in rural provinces like Camagüey and Las Tunas, fear of the government was almost as strong as fear of God. In a Havana press briefing just days before the storm made landfall, President Machado was warned of unusual cyclonic pressure zones forming in the southern Caribbean. But in a time of social unrest, officials feared mass panic more than wind damage. Warnings were delayed. In many places, they never came at all. The storm takes shape. The hurricane first showed its strength on October 30th, when it passed south of Jamaica as a tropical storm. Within hours, it intensified into a full hurricane and then quickly, almost unnaturally, into a Category 5. Its eye widened. The outer bands reached across hundreds of miles. Winds exceeded 175 miles per hour, 280 kilometers per hour. What followed was what meteorologists today describe as explosive intensification, made possible by the warm late-season Caribbean waters and favorable wind shear conditions. By the evening of November 8th, the storm had curved north and was barreling directly toward Cuba's southern coastline. But unlike modern hurricanes, which are tracked every second by satellite and radar, this storm arrived without a face. It was not named. It had no advisories, no color-coded warnings, no hashtags. Only the animals knew it was coming. Flocks of egrets flew inland. Sea turtles crawled up past the high tide line. Fishermen reported sharks circling abnormally close to shore. And still the children played. Still the markets opened. Timeline of miscommunication. By midnight on November 9th, the storm center was just offshore of Camagüey province. Some families in Santa Cruz del Sur had heard vague radio bulletins from Havana. Messages crackled with interference, urging precaution and evacuation of flood-prone areas. But there was no official local order. No trucks. No coordinated exodus. For many, especially Afro-Cubans and poor laborers living in wooden thatch housing, there was nowhere to go. Their entire lives were tied to the land beneath them, the same land that would be underwater by sunrise. Some sought shelter in schools. Others tied animals to trees. A few climbed into the rafters of churches and waited. The calm before the death. At 4 a.m. on November 9th, the winds began to howl. By 5:30 a.m., roofs were being torn off homes in the easternmost barrios. Flying debris decapitated coconut trees. The sound of the wind, described in one survivor's diary as the scream of all the devils of the sea, made it impossible to hear neighbors cry for help. Then the sea began to move. It didn't crash, not at first. It crept. And then it rose, all at once. A 21-foot storm surge over 6.4 meters ripped inland like a tidal blade, demolishing buildings, lifting entire wooden houses off their stilts. Churches collapsed. Cattle were swept out to sea. Eyewitnesses would later say the sea became indistinguishable from the sky, black, endless, and roaring. Survivor testimony, Maria Elena Soto. In an oral history recorded by Cuban historian Dr. Luis Zuniga in the 1950s, a woman named Maria Elena Soto, then 17, recounted, "We had tied ourselves with ropes inside my uncle's house. I was holding my little brother's hand. When the wall came off, he went with it. I never saw him again. We weren't told to leave. Nobody came. The government didn't care for poor people." Her account, long buried in university archives, became one of hundreds that began to surface decades after the disaster, each revealing the same pattern. No warning, no aid, no accountability. The morning after. By 9 a.m. the storm had passed. But nothing was left. Santa Cruz del Sur was gone. Flattened. Swept away. Corpses littered the streets and mangroves. Bodies were found tangled in fishing nets, others trapped beneath overturned ox carts. The official death toll was eventually placed at over 2,800, but researchers now believe the real number may have exceeded 5,000, making it one of the deadliest hurricanes in Caribbean history. The town was not rebuilt in its original location. Survivors, many of them traumatized, widowed, or orphaned, were relocated inland. The scars, however, did not move. They remained. The hurricane was gone. But something more dangerous remained. In the wake of the 1932 Cuba hurricane, silence descended over the island, not the silence of shock or mourning or respect for the dead. This silence was enforced. Intentional. Engineered. It began in the capital. In Havana, President Gerardo Machado's regime was already buckling under economic collapse, corruption scandals, and intensifying revolutionary resistance. The last thing his administration needed was a humanitarian catastrophe exposing government failure. The storm's death toll, property destruction, and absence of warning systems risked public outrage. So the story was changed, softened, redirected, and in some cases, deleted. Government memos and the disinformation campaign. Declassified internal memos from Cuba's Ministry of the Interior, preserved in the Archivo Nacional de Cuba, show that just 2 days after the hurricane made landfall, senior government officials instructed provincial governors to avoid using phrases like catastrophe, neglect, or failure of warning. In one memo dated November 11, 1932, a communications officer wrote, "It is imperative that radio bulletins reflect stability and national unity. Avoid exaggeration. Use language of unexpected weather anomaly rather than hurricane disaster." Newspapers were quietly warned. Focus on stories of heroism, not loss. Limit photographs of bodies or destroyed homes. And above all, never report an official death toll higher than what the central government released. This wasn't merely public relations. It was a state-managed suppression of memory. The press, a complicit witness. At the time, Cuba's press was under tight surveillance by the Machado regime. Journalists who published anti-government editorials faced arrest or worse. And while international reporters, such as those from the Associated Press and New York Times, documented the devastation in brief wire stories, domestic coverage was muted. The leading Havana newspaper Diario de la Marina ran a front-page story on November 12 that read, "Santa Cruz del Sur affected by unusual sea storm, aid on the way. No photos. No casualties. No urgency." This would be the public tone for weeks. And yet, the country knew. Entire train cars were loaded with pine coffins and sent south. Priests refused to ring church bells out of grief. Soldiers burned bodies in mass funeral pyres to prevent disease. Still, the headlines stayed quiet. The radio archives, what wasn't said. Recordings from Radio Lavin, one of the few privately operated stations at the time, reveal a rare contradiction. an announcer named Carlos Emilio Ruiz aired a 15-minute monologue just days after the hurricane, describing the scene in Camagüey. There are no buildings. The trees are not trees. They are twisted bones. I spoke to a mother whose three children were swept away. She has not cried yet. She cannot. That broadcast never aired again. The station was fined. Ruiz was later arrested for inciting unrest. All surviving audio from that period exists only in private archives or from recordings smuggled out of the country decades later by exiled historians. The vanished investigation. Perhaps the most damning silence of all. There was no national investigation into the 1932 Cuba hurricane. No audit of the meteorological failures. No accountability for the lack of evacuation orders. No hearings. No resignations. A leaked internal report by the Servicio Meteorologico Nacional was filed in December of that year but marked confidential, archivo cerrado. It outlined that 24 hours prior to landfall, Havana's Central Weather Bureau had already received full wind and pressure reports from a Panamanian ship stationed south of Camagüey, that the trajectory toward Santa Cruz del Sur had been predicted, but warnings were deemed logistically too late and politically dangerous, that one government advisor had recommended an emergency bulletin broadcast, but was ignored. That file was never released to the public. Most citizens never knew it existed. Oral histories, resisting the erasure. What the government could not control were the voices of survivors. And in the decades that followed, those voices became the only true archive. In the 1950s, Cuban anthropologist Elisa Dominguez de Guerra conducted a series of unfiltered oral interviews with storm survivors across Camagüey province. In interview after interview, a chilling theme emerged. People remembered being told nothing. We saw clouds and wind, but there were no trucks, no radios, no one saying to run, said Juan Ignacio Perdomo, a cane cutter who lost his wife and two sons. Afterward, they told us to rebuild, but not to talk. In nearby Najasa, old women met at the Catholic Church every November 9th and lit candles in silence. It wasn't a government holiday. It wasn't an official memorial. It was cultural resistance, quiet, unspoken, but defiantly real. Why the silence was strategic. The silence wasn't just about preserving Machado's rule. It was also about preserving an illusion that Cuba was modern, prepared, safe, a partner worthy of U.S. investment and regional prestige. The truth of a country unready, unequipped, and unwilling to protect its poorest citizens threatened that narrative. So the bodies were buried. The stories were buried with them. And the hurricane, the deadliest in Cuban history, became a ghost in textbooks, a footnote in newsreels, a storm whose name was never given because its truth was never allowed to live. History is not just what is recorded. It is what is remembered. Though the 1932 hurricane was censored from headlines, silenced by government policy, and hidden from school curriculums, it remained alive in the most unshakable place of all, the Caribbean imagination. In this chapter, we follow the path of survival stories that refuse to be buried. From the whispered ballads in Camagüey's cane fields, to the rebirth of memory during the Cuban Revolution, to the songs and literature that reinserted the forgotten dead into the cultural bloodstream, this is how a nameless storm refused to die. Musical notes: the first song, Viento del Diablo. In 1934, 2 years after the disaster, a blind Afro-Cuban trace player named Tata Enrique Ramos performed a song in the small town of Guaymaro. Its title, Viento del Diablo, Devil's Wind. It never aired on radio. It was banned at the provincial fair. But the lyrics survived through generations of oral repetition. La mar no vino sola. Vino con hambre de huso y alma. Nadia grito, Nadia aviso, solo el diablo soplo y calo. The sea didn't come alone, it came hungry for bone and soul. No one shouted, no one warned, only the devil blew and fell silent. Despite official attempts to silence it, the song became a kind of oral requiem across rural eastern Cuba, performed quietly in homes at funerals, even by exiles in Miami and Mexico. The storm was no longer a weather event. It had become folklore, a myth built on fact, carrying names, grief, and warning. Books: The Revolutionary Reawakening. In 1959, the Cuban Revolution overthrew the U.S.-backed Batista government and brought Fidel Castro to power. the new regime launched an aggressive campaign of literacy, oral history, and cultural reclamation, especially in rural and Afro-Cuban communities long ignored by Havana elites. It was in this climate of rebirth that the 1932 hurricane re-entered the national conversation. In 1964, historian and anthropologist Dr. Luis Zuniga Gonzalez published Las Voces del Viento, a rare academic text that included transcribed testimonies from hurricane survivors, previously dismissed as folk tales. Zuniga's book was controversial for one reason. It included the true death toll estimates and cited buried government records. It sold only 300 copies, but in the barrios, the name Zuniga became a kind of code word. At local poetry readings, elders would stand and read verses about a storm with no name. Revolution had cracked open the archive. Framed picture art as resistance. In the early 1970s, Cuban painter Lázaro Blanco created a three-panel oil painting titled El Mar Que Se Tragó a Todos, The Sea That Swallowed Everyone. It depicted a ghost town underwater, skeletal hands reaching upward, a church bell floating beside a lifeless horse, a girl clinging to a drowned rosary. The exhibit was displayed only once at a private gallery in Santiago de Cuba, and then removed for being too politically suggestive. But photos of the painting spread to art collectives across the Caribbean. In Grenada, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, artists began revisiting their own forgotten storms, using Cuba's 1932 disaster as a symbol of climate violence meeting colonial neglect. Art had become archive. Microphone echoes in reggae, calypso, and salsa. By the 1980s, regional Caribbean musicians were using storms as metaphors for oppression, resistance, and survival. And though they rarely mentioned the 1932 hurricane by name, perhaps because it had none, the patterns were unmistakable. In 1987, a roots reggae artist from Montego Bay named Ja Ciro released the track Before the Wave, which contained the lines, Me mudder each run but de people age wait, dem neva hear de voice of state. This was not about Hurricane Gilbert. Not entirely. It was about a silence that had haunted the Caribbean for half a century. In salsa, the Puerto Rican band La Resistencia released Santa Cruz in 1991, a fictional love ballad that ends with the lovers drowned in Un mar que mencha con calma, a sea that lied with calm. The song never mentions Cuba, but Caribbean listeners knew what it was about. Loudspeaker testimony meets technology. By the late 1990s, independent documentarians and diaspora scholars began publishing audio recordings and microfilms online, finally breaking the dam that had held back the truth of 1932. One of the most downloaded files in 2001 on Cuba-based internet networks was a digitized, re-edited copy of Carlos Emilio Ruiz's band radio monologue, recovered by his grandson and uploaded anonymously. For many young Cubans, this was the first time they heard a first-hand account of what had happened in Santa Cruz del Sur, in their own language from their own land. History had found its voice again. Repeat button intergenerational memory. When children inherit the wind. In rural towns, the hurricane became ritual. On November 9th, candles were lit not only in Cuba, but by Cuban descendants in Puerto Rico, Tampa, Kingston, Toronto, and even as far as London. The night the sea came home became part of the cultural calendar, a ghost date. Children were taught to listen to the wind, to pay attention to silences, to fear the ocean's stillness more than its waves. The 1932 hurricane had no official holiday, but it had legacy. In most countries, a natural disaster of this scale would be etched into the national conscience, taught in schools, commemorated yearly, immortalized in public record. But the 1932 Cuba hurricane, which killed more than 2,800 people and left tens of thousands displaced, has been relegated to the footnotes of Caribbean history. This chapter investigates the systematic erasure of the storm from official records, the institutional apathy that followed, and the geopolitical motivations that led to one of the greatest tragedies in the region being almost completely forgotten. A storm without a name. First, there is the matter of identity. Unlike Katrina, Dorian, or Maria, the 1932 storm never received a formal name. In fact, the naming system for Atlantic hurricanes wouldn't be standardized until 1953, over two decades later. Until then, storms were often named after saints' feast days, affected towns, or not at all. For the people of Santa Cruz del Sur, the hurricane was simply El Ciclón, a force of nature without a face. this namelessness made it easier to bury. Without a proper name, it became harder for journalists, foreign aid organizations, and scholars to reference the disaster in archives. Try searching for it. It slips through databases, gets confused with other storms, or disappears behind vague terms like 1932 event. Altered death tolls and withheld data. According to meteorological historian Dr. Emilio Velez Rodriguez, several discrepancies exist in Cuban and international records. In Cuban internal government reports, the official death toll remained fixed at 2,870. But U.S. consular documents, declassified in 1981, estimate the number to be closer to 5,100, citing mass graves, unregistered casualties, and hundreds of uncounted Black and Indigenous rural residents. The Red Cross made an internal note that due to local political complications, their disaster survey team was denied full access to affected zones in Camagüey. The numbers weren't just wrong. They were manipulated. One document, uncovered in 2007 at the University of Miami's Cuban Heritage Collection, shows a typed letter from Havana's regional planning office instructing field surveyors to use conservative estimates and to avoid inflammatory language when documenting storm damage for future policy review. The erasure wasn't passive. It was calculated. The textbook blackout. Between 1940 and 1980, no official Cuban school textbook mentioned the 1932 hurricane. Even in the post-revolutionary era, when nationalistic pride fueled the celebration of Cuban resilience and working-class history, this storm remained a phantom. Scholars suggest three likely reasons. It predated the revolution, and thus fell outside the state's preferred narrative arc of post-1959 heroism. It exposed institutional failures, from disaster preparedness to inequity in aid delivery, especially to rural Afro-Cuban communities. It was deeply tied to U.S.-Cuban relations, with significant American economic interests in the region at the time, including sugar mills that refused to evacuate their workers. In textbooks where hurricanes were mentioned, priority was given to later storms like Hurricane Flora, 1963, which occurred under the revolutionary government and fit better into the Castro regime's myth of protective leadership and responsive socialism. The 1932 storm had no such value, so was cut. International aid, redirection, and exploitation. The international response to the storm was limited and delayed. Though the U.S. Red Cross pledged initial support, records show that less than 20% of promised aid ever reached Santa Cruz del Sur. Where did the money go? A 1933 congressional subcommittee in the U.S., formed to audit foreign aid expenditures during the Great Depression, found that portions of the relief funds were diverted to stabilizing Machado's collapsing government, repairing American-owned railroads and cane plantations, urban rebuilding projects in Havana, far from the disaster zone. The victims became a footnote in someone else's recovery plan. And perhaps most troubling, no international investigation was ever conducted into the failure to warn residents in time. Cuba was still viewed as a strategic protectorate by American business and political elites, and criticizing its leadership publicly risked disruption of economic alliances. No monuments, no names. Unlike Hurricanes Maria or Gilbert, there are no national monuments to the victims of the 1932 disaster. In Santa Cruz del Sur, a small cross marks the rebuilt inland town square, placed not by the government but by survivors themselves. There is no National Remembrance Day, no museum exhibit, no hurricane archive open to the public. This is not absence by accident. This is historical erasure by design, whose lives get remembered. The erasure raises a devastating question that echoes across the Caribbean. Whose deaths matter? In the aftermath of the 1932 hurricane, the victims were overwhelmingly poor Afro-Cuban and rural populations already marginalized under Machado's regime. In letters written by survivors to newspapers and parishes, many preserved by families, a recurring sentiment emerges. We were not counted because we were not wanted. Not as voters. Not as citizens. Not as Cubans. To forget a storm is to forget the people it erased. And to do that is to erase their humanity. Modern implications. The failure to preserve the truth of 1932 has long-term consequences. Disaster education in eastern Cuba remains uneven, especially in underfunded rural schools. urban planners ignore historic flood zones due to incomplete storm data. Younger generations grow up unaware that their great-grandparents died in the deadliest hurricane in the island's modern history. In a region where climate change threatens stronger, more frequent hurricanes, forgetting the lessons of 1932 isn't just tragic. It's dangerous. If silence was imposed by the state, then the truth would have to survive in fragments, buried in diaries, whispered in kitchens, preserved in family trunks, and eventually uploaded into the cloud. This chapter is not about the hurricane itself, not the wind or the water or the destruction. It's about the people, across decades and oceans, who refuse to let it be forgotten. From retired professors scanning tattered letters in Toronto, to Cuban exiles building open-source timelines in Miami, to youth collectives in Santiago de Cuba gathering oral testimony on smartphones, this is the story of the digital resistance. It begins with one hard truth. There is no centralized public archive of the 1932 Cuba hurricane, but now there is a movement to build one. The Exile Archivists, Saving History from Disappearance. In 2006, Dr. Daniela Reyes Pena, a Cuban-American historian and archivist at the University of Florida, launched a personal project. Her goal: to trace every scrap of survivor testimony and documentation related to the 1932 disaster. She found her first source in an unlikely place, a pawn shop in Little Havana. An old leather-bound journal, water-stained, faded handwriting, dated November 13, 1932. Inside, a first-hand account by a carpenter named Osvaldo Gutierrez, describing his escape from Santa Cruz del Sur with his wife and three children. "We tied our daughter to the mango tree. We held her tight in the branches as the sea took our home. We didn't scream. We just prayed louder than the wind." From that moment, Dr. Reyes Pena began building what is now the digital memory map of the 1932 hurricane, a geolocated open-source database that collects survivor testimonies, photographs of wreckage and grave sites, audio recordings of oral traditions, ship logs, barometric readings and weather bulletins, newspaper clippings from the U.S., Dominican Republic and Cuba. Her work would later be expanded by universities in Spain, Mexico, and Canada, creating the first international digital footprint of the storm, recording the elders, voices before they vanish. While documents can be recovered, human voices cannot be resurrected once they're lost. That urgency is what drove the youth-led community group Memoria Viva in Camagüey to begin recording survivors and descendants before time could steal them too. Armed with smartphones and a $500 community grant, they began visiting farms, nursing homes, and village churches, interviewing anyone over the age of 80. The stories that emerged were staggering. One woman, Dona Lydia Maceo, remembered her grandmother tying tin cans to the ankles of her children so they could be heard above the water if they floated away. Another man, Antonio Coba, described a neighbor who carved the names of his family into the rafters of their collapsing home, in case only the wood was found. Each recording was time-stamped, transcribed, and uploaded to an encrypted server hosted in Mexico, far from the eyes of Cuban censors. These were no longer just memories. They were evidence. Photo resurrections, when a face rewrites history. In 2018, a rare photograph resurfaced on social media. It showed a mass grave being dug near Santa Cruz del Sur, with a handwritten note on the back that read, "My brother is somewhere in here. November 1932. The photo went viral within the Cuban diaspora. Within days, digital artists enhanced the image using AI facial recognition tools, not to identify anyone in the grave, but to map the cemetery's layout and cross-reference it with satellite coordinates. It matched perfectly with a grove of palm trees behind the rebuilt inland village. That location is now unofficially called El Cementerio del Viento, the Cemetery of the Wind. Locals have begun leaving candles there every November 9th. Diaspora scholars, filling the institutional void. In the absence of Cuban state support, it is the Caribbean diaspora, from academic circles to activist networks, who are taking up the task of historical repair. The Afro-Caribbean Cultural Trust in Toronto created a virtual museum exhibit titled Hurricanes Without Names, centering the 1932 Cuba storm as a case study in environmental racism and archival erasure. At the University of the West Indies, a comparative climate memory course now includes the 1932 hurricane alongside Dorian, Maria, and Gilbert, placing it back where it belongs, in the Caribbean's intergenerational trauma map. Digital warfare, the state strikes back. But history, even digital, does not go uncontested. In 2020, several Cuban-run sites that hosted storm documentation were geo-blocked within Cuba's national intranet. Archive uploads from Camagüey were flagged for counter-revolutionary content. Some community historians were questioned. Others saw their data mysteriously deleted. The storm that had been suppressed for 90 years was still being suppressed. But the tools had changed. Now history can be mirrored, backed up, spread globally in seconds. And each attempt at censorship becomes proof of why the archive matters. Healing through truth. For many, this isn't about historical accuracy. It's about healing. Healing for the communities who were never recognized. Healing for the descendants who inherited fear without knowing why. Healing for a region that continues to weather storms, literal and political, and carry the scars in silence. Each testimony, every uploaded map, each whispered name added to the digital roll call of the dead, is a defiance, a memory turned into resistance. History tells what happened. Justice asks what must be done. For nearly a century, the victims of the 1932 Cuba hurricane have waited, not for sympathy but for acknowledgement. Not for charity but for accountability. In this chapter, we move from the terrain of memory to the front lines of advocacy. We examine what justice could and should look like, not symbolically but concretely, for the storm's forgotten dead and their living descendants. The question is not whether this hurricane was a tragedy. That is beyond dispute. The question is, who should be responsible for what was never made right? The costs that were never paid. Let's start with what was lost, not just in lives but in livelihoods. Tens of thousands of Cubans, primarily poor, rural, and Afro-Caribbean, lost everything in the 1932 hurricane. Land, livestock, property, tools, and homes. Most were never compensated. Those who did receive aid were given it not in the form of funds, but in temporary shelter, often no more than tents or repurposed cane boxes. Reparations were never discussed. Why? Because to offer restitution would mean publicly acknowledging that warnings were suppressed, evacuations were denied, and storm planning was politically blocked. In a 1933 policy review, Cuba's Reconstruction Ministry quietly decided that property loss in the southern provinces would not be eligible for national rebuilding funds. The logic? The area's strategic insignificance to national industry. In other words, they were too poor to matter. International legal responsibility. Could there be a case for reparations under modern human rights law? Legal scholars argue yes. The storm's timeline, with clear evidence that the Cuban government and its American intelligence counterparts knew of the hurricane's path and failed to act, presents grounds for what's called retroactive institutional negligence. In 2014, an academic paper by Caribbean legal theorist Dr. Yara Toussaint proposed a framework for historical climate justice in the region. She argued that Cuba's government bears ethical responsibility for its failure to warn. U.S. entities, including the State Department and Red Cross, contributed to the erasure by diverting funds and withholding data. International insurance conglomerates that profited from undercompensated claims in the aftermath still exist and could be held corporately liable under reparative justice standards. To date, no legal action has been taken. But the precedent is growing. What official acknowledgement would require? Justice doesn't always begin in court. Sometimes it begins with a microphone. For decades, survivors and their descendants have called for three simple formal actions from the Cuban government. A National Day of Remembrance on November 9th, in honor of those killed and in recognition of the failure to warn. An official state apology, delivered at Santa Cruz del Sur by a national representative, acknowledging the disaster and the government's role in suppressing the truth. A permanent memorial, built in the original town's location, with the known and recovered names of the victims etched into stone. These are not demands for money. They are demands for memory, legitimized, engraved, unerasable. Intergenerational consequences. Trauma without closure. For the descendants of survivors, the trauma lives on. Psychologists studying intergenerational grief in Caribbean populations have noted that children and grandchildren of hurricane survivors often inherit invisible anxieties, a chronic fear of storms, distrust of government warnings, and a tendency to stockpile goods without understanding why. In Santa Cruz del Sur, a survey conducted in 2015 found that 67% of youth under 25 could not name the 1932 hurricane, but 82% said they did not trust official weather bulletins. This is trauma passed down with no closure. In one recorded interview, a woman named Myra Del Pilar, whose great-grandmother died in the storm, said, "We don't want compensation. We want context. I want my daughter to grow up knowing that our grief is real. Not folklore, not fiction, but fact. That what happened to our people mattered. Policy pathways to reparative justice. Justice, if pursued, doesn't have to be abstract." Experts have proposed several tangible policy actions, including creation of a National Disaster Truth Commission to review state records on natural catastrophes and issue findings to the public. Inclusion of the 1932 hurricane in national curriculum, with access to survivor testimony and community-generated research. Funding of climate resilience projects specifically in historically neglected areas like Santa Cruz del Sur. Not as aid, but as amends. These are not impossible goals, but they require political will and moral courage. Caribbean solidarity. A regional reckoning. The Caribbean as a region stands at a crossroads. Climate change is accelerating. Sea levels are rising. Storms are becoming stronger. But the past teaches us something the future still struggles to acknowledge. Disasters do not strike equally. They expose and exploit existing inequalities, racial, economic, political. And so, the case of the 1932 Cuba hurricane is not just a national wound. It is a regional warning. To forget this storm is to leave its injustices unhealed and unprepared for the next. Legacies are not inherited. They're built, sometimes in rubble, sometimes in rhythm, sometimes in the absence of everything except memory. As we near the end of our journey through the devastation, erasure, rediscovery, and call for justice that followed the 1932 Cuba hurricane, we arrive here, at the place where silence ends. In this chapter, we explore how communities, creators, and cultural leaders have reclaimed the narrative. Not for vengeance, not for spectacle, but for legacy, the right to say we were here, and we mattered. Theater as testimony, olas de sangre, waves of blood. In 2016, Cuban playwright Sarai Robena debuted a stage production in Santiago de Cuba titled Olas de Sangre. It was not a traditional play. There were no named characters. No single narrative arc. Only interwoven monologues, voices of the dead, imagined from real testimonies and letters. A drowned child, a mourning mother, a priest who locked the church doors to stop the surge and survived to regret it. The performance was met with gasps, tears, and two standing ovations. Then, almost as quickly, it disappeared. The Ministry of Culture refused funding for its touring edition. But video clips were uploaded to Vimeo and YouTube. Subtitled versions were created by Cuban students in Canada, Martinique, and Trinidad. And suddenly, Olas de Sangre was being screened in classrooms across the diaspora, from Harlem to Barbados to Belize. Theater had done what textbooks would not. Music as memorial. When the sea found its song. In 2020, Jamaican-Cuban reggae artist Ayana Al released a haunting ballad titled La Novena de Nadia, The Ninth of No One. Released on November 9th, the anniversary of the hurricane, the song opens with crashing waves layered over a heartbeat-like bass. Then comes the hook. No bell, no siren, no candle was lit. So I light one now for all they forget. The track spread quickly. Radio stations in Havana, Miami, and London picked it up. It became the unofficial anthem for the grassroots hashtag Recorder El Ciclón movement. A coalition of artists, researchers, and descendants fighting for the storm's permanent inclusion in Cuban historical education. And perhaps most poignantly, at the close of every concert, Ayana Al stands silent for 60 seconds. Not for applause, for memory. Murals in the ruins. In 2022, a team of young artists in Camagüey launched Project Refaga, a series of hurricane-themed murals painted on crumbling buildings in forgotten towns. Their goal: reclaim spaces lost to silence. One mural depicts a woman holding back the ocean with her body. Another shows names raining from the sky, some legible, some blurred, all falling into the sea. These murals are illegal under current Cuban law. viewed as unauthorized interventions of public property. And yet no one paints over them, not even the authorities, because even regimes understand some walls should speak. Curriculum from the ground up. Across the Caribbean and diaspora, teachers are no longer waiting for state approval. In classrooms from Guadeloupe to Guyana, educators are introducing independent hurricane memory modules, blending science, storytelling, and survivor archives. One such initiative launched by the Diaspora Memory Collective includes lesson plans using oral histories from Santa Cruz del Sur, activities that let students build digital memorials, projects that compare colonial disaster response models with modern ones. For many students, this is their first time hearing about the 1932 Cuba hurricane, but not the last. Annual gathering, Memory is Protest. On November 9, 2023, 91 years after the storm, over 500 people gathered at the reconstructed town square in Santa Cruz del Sur. Some came from as far as Venezuela and New York. Others walked from the nearby sugar fields. There were no speeches, no flags, only candles, and a single sign hung from a banyan tree. We remember what you tried to erase. That night, someone played La Novena de Nadia on a speaker. Children lit floating candles and sent them down the flooded canals. No officials attended. No media covered it. But it was documented. On phones. In journals. And most importantly, in each other. Legacy is a tide that can't be stopped. You cannot bury history forever. You cannot silence memory once it begins to sing. And you cannot erase what has been carved into the soul of a people. The 1932 Cuba hurricane, long denied a name, a monument, or a national truth, now lives again. Not in vengeance, but in legacy. And that legacy isn't just Cuban. It belongs to the Caribbean, to anyone who's ever faced the sea and prayed, to every child who watches the sky and feels something ancient stir. This isn't just a storm that happened. It's a storm that still speaks. Chapter close. Seamless lead into final chapter 8, smiley face. And yet, legacy must also warn. In our final chapter, we explore how the forgotten truths of 1932 now inform how we prepare for the next storm, the next silence, the next injustice that waits behind the wind. Because what we remember can save us, and what we forget can kill again. The hurricane is long gone, but its warnings remain. In this final chapter, we close where we began, not with a storm, but with silence. A silence that killed. A silence that was orchestrated. And a silence that we now know can be just as deadly as wind or flood. As the Caribbean faces a future of intensified hurricanes, rising seas, and widening inequality, we must ask, have we truly learned from the storm that history buried? This is not a story that ends. It is one that returns every time the sky darkens again. Modern storms, old mistakes. In 2017, when Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, the official death toll was initially reported as 64. Months later, independent investigations and statistical analyses revealed the number was over 4,600. Delays in aid. Suppressed data. Underreported losses. Sound familiar? What happened in 1932 was not an isolated failure. It was a template. And it's one we are still repeating across the Caribbean and the global South. In the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian. In Dominica after Hurricane Maria. In Haiti after nearly every major disaster. The poor are left to fend for themselves. The survivors become forgotten. And the systems that fail them are quietly excused in the name of resilience. But resilience without justice is just survival. And survival is not enough. From wind to warning, the role of memory in preparedness. Today, satellites track hurricanes in real time. Meteorological centers issue color-coded alerts. And yet, many communities, especially in the rural Caribbean, still do not trust those systems. Why? Because storms are not just natural. They are political. And history has shown that warnings often come late, or not at all. What the 1932 hurricane teaches us is this. Memory is not just about the past. It is a survival tool. When we remember how communities were failed, we build better evacuation plans. When we remember who was left behind, we prioritize access to vulnerable populations. When we name the silences, we ensure they are not repeated. Memory in the Caribbean must be tactical, not just commemorative, protective. what the future demands. The future will not ask if we mourn the past. It will ask what we did with it. So let this be our blueprint. Education must include historical disasters. Not just the science of storms, but the politics of response. Infrastructure must be shaped not just by forecasts, but by ancestral flood maps, oral history, and community knowledge. Recovery must center the people most often silenced, not after the storm, but before it strikes. Voices must be recorded now, not years later, not once the wounds are beyond language. We do not have the luxury of forgetting anymore. Climate change has made every lesson sacred, every silence a crime. The storm returns, in culture, in protest, in truth. As we speak in classrooms, murals, stage plays, and whispered prayers across the Caribbean, the 1932 Cuba hurricane is finally being named, finally being taught, finally being heard. But it took decades. What if it hadn't? What if those people had been warned? What if those children had lived? What if the truth had been spoken when it mattered most? We cannot change what happened, but we can change what happens next. And we can do it with what they left us. A tree they clung to. A song that survived. A grave that was never marked. A memory that refused to die. Closing words. This was not just a hurricane. This was a reckoning. A storm that tore open the Caribbean sky and revealed what was hidden beneath. It asked one question then, and it asks it again now. When the next storm comes, will we be ready? Or will silence win again?